se passe.
My name is Ryan. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Ryan.
All right. Hey. How do you know Santa Claus was an alcoholic? Because he's always taking everybody's inventory.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices. Make noise that might/will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away. Ask God to help you stay focused on the steps to study tonight. If everyone will, please join me in the fog light prayer if you don't know it. It's usually up top here, but it's not. It's on the back of the chairs if you need it. God, let your love shine through me.
Fog away. Those who are lost, sick, and dying, my love, forgive me.
There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked a friend, Johnny, to come up here and read Spiritual Experience. Johnny. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know one of it.
Good evening. My name is, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Johnny. 6 months today. The spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in the book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that the personality changes or religious experiences must have been in the nature of sudden or spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it is not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at least by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. Amen. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unexpected, unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that an alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance and belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. Quote, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Johnny. So during the meeting, please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. If you got to use the bathroom, just wait till after the speaker's done or go out the back door downstairs. It's a tech-free meeting, so please put the phones away, put them on airplane mode, meeting mode, or just turn them off. All right, so now the fun part of the meeting. It's the meat and potatoes of the meeting. I'm going to introduce our speaker who's been with us. He's been with us the last 8 weeks, so this would make it his ninth session. We don't really go by step here. We go by sessions because, you know, it's wherever God takes him during the moment. So we may or may not hear something about the ninth step tonight. But I'm sure we'll get a story, but I won't make any promises. But This man, I mean, he's just been a luxury to have him here the past 8 weeks. I was telling him before the meeting, I've heard him a lot. I've heard him do a lot of series, and this one's just really, it's really just taken off for me. He just has such a ability to relate with the real alcoholic, and that's just a gift of its own. So I'm going to bring Pat up here for his ninth session.
A recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat Rutten. And thanks to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. AA didn't just save my life, but it gave me one worth living. Absolutely love my life today. I actually have a blast in recovery. There's nowhere else I would rather be. I mean, that's just a fact. You know, we were just saying that when I sat down. It's just like I'm home, you know. I mean, all that out there is out there, and now I'm here and doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And this is not a comfortable step for me. The ninth step is a difficult step for me. Our book warns us about morbid reflection and dwelling on the past. We won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And then 11 warns us about this morbid reflection. But it's still not comfortable to look back at. I left a wake of destruction back there. And I would be lying to you if I told you I didn't regret any of that. And I get, by the way, I get that everything had to take place just the way it did for me to be here tonight or for me to be where I'm at in my life. Norm and I were talking before the meeting that, I'm blessed. I am blessed beyond what I deserve. You know, thank God I didn't get what I deserve. You know, but, you know, I walk this walk with a woman I love dearly. And it's just amazing. I mean, I never thought that would happen for me. I never thought that I would really, first off, know how to love somebody because I was a taker all my life. And know how to give to somebody without expecting something and have that person reciprocate. And not just that, but be able to walk this walk, to walk the road of recovery together, to walk. You know, I talk about relationships in early recovery, why we should stay out of them. But I want to tell you something. There is nothing more beautiful than two people in a relationship walking this walk, you know, and I get to do that, you know. And so as much as I regret what took place in my past with my exes and my children and that kind of stuff, I know that without that, I don't land here. And where I'm at today spiritually and where I'm at today relationally, I just wouldn't be there. It wouldn't happen. I get that everything had to happen exactly the way it did for me to end up where I'm at. But it doesn't make it any easier to talk about it. So it's difficult. The ninth step is difficult for me. It's funny because it's been my home group. We're on the ninth step on Monday nights. We did at least four times a year, we do a workshop, a two-way prayer, three-way prayer workshop. I touched on that a little bit, I guess, last week. But it's what they were doing in early AA. It's what the Oxford groups were doing in prayer and meditation. They would sit and get quiet and it really self-examination through prayer and meditation. It would let the voices come. It wasn't about silencing the voices. It was about letting them come, let them roll and record them, you know, and write them down and then share those voices, share that, whatever you thought came from God or not. You know, it's about recording random thinking, random thoughts. So Tuesday night about four times a year, we do the workshop it's about an hour deal, and it's you sit quietly, and we do some music meditation, and then you sit quietly, and you let the voices run, and you record it. And then you share what you recorded, and then other people share what they recorded, and then you share what you think maybe targeted what was on your mind. And it's all about step nine. It's just, you know, I'm there. I'm in step nine, and a lot of it has to do with past relationships, you know, because you know what I've learned about relationships is successful relationships require two things. They require two givers and two forgivers, you know. And I know that today. I didn't know that ever. I was a freaking taker, you know. And I was selfish, self-centered, driven by fear, just as our book says, and I took. And whatever pleasures were out there for me, I would indulge. You know, if it didn't matter how it affected you, and it didn't matter the impact that it had on your life. You know, I was a pleasure seeker. You know, I was always looking for more. There was never enough of anything in my life. And I destroyed. And I like to say not purposely, but I don't know. You know, I destroyed beautiful relationships for a moment of pleasure, for a single moment of pleasure. And it's regrettable. It's really regrettable. Some beautiful people that I happen to be involved in, and people who loved me dearly. And I look back at that, and I changed their lives for them, and not for the better. You know, not for the better. We talked last week in step 8 about getting honest with a list, you know, getting true to a list as to what the harm was, not what I did wrong, but what the harm was, and how much I may have harmed those people in their future relationships or their future lives, you know, how they would never trust anybody again, possibly, because of just having a connection with me, you know, and that's sad, you know, that's sad. I didn't plan on going here, but here we are. I have two boys, and my one son was 12 when I got sober. My other son was 2. The difference in these two boys' personalities is night and day. You know, one of them saw violence in the house. You know, the other one doesn't know me with a drink in my hand. All he knows is dad who practices AA principles. The other one had 12 years of some dysfunction. You know, there was violence in the home. There was violence towards him. And I mean, I never touched him, but there was, you know, I'll give you an example of that. You know, my sons, 2 years ago, we were up in Jacksonville for Christmas at the boat parade. And we went to dinner afterwards, and my sons were laughing about remembering my oldest son locking himself in his bedroom and me putting my fist through the door and opening the door from the inside. Now, they were laughing about that situation. I wanted to hide. You know, I wanted to go get into a room somewhere by myself and go, oh, my God, I can't believe that I inflicted that kind of damage on a child, that's a memory, that's a funny memory that they have of me. Now, it's good that they can laugh about it today, you know, because that's not who I am today, and they both know that that's not who I am today. But that's sad, you know, that would be a childhood memory. So my oldest son grew up in that kind of an atmosphere where I would lose it. You know, I mean, I didn't have the patience and the tolerance that I have today. You know, a lot of his discipline was intimidation. You know, motivation through intimidation, kind of how I grew up in Catholic school, you know. I mean, that's all I knew. Those were my role models. I had a violent father, I had a violent uncle, I had a violent stepfather. You know, that's all I knew was discipline through intimidation. Not so with my other son, you know. And like I say, their personalities are night and day. My oldest son is like me. Shoots from the hip, doesn't think when he talks, you know. He moves before he knows where he's going, runs into shit. That's what I do, you know. I mean, I just, you know, my mind says go, I go. I don't even look where I'm going, you know, and I hit stuff, you know. And my other son is calculated, my youngest one, calculated, thinks everything through, doesn't respond, doesn't go off with the first thing that he's thinking, doesn't come out of his mouth. He processes it, and then he responds, you know. He's, you know, we all dive together. You know, and he's the guy you want to dive with. He's the guy that's calculated and safe and makes sure everything's clear. Me and my other son, we're like gerbils. We're down there. You know, we're all over the place. You know what I mean? But he's the one that grabs us. I mean, my son reels me in. Hold on a second. You know, he's military. You know, he ended up 7 years of military, you know, and today he's a successful attorney, which is just amazing. You know, but and my other son's successful too. Engineer, been with Lockheed for years. You know, he travels all over the world. One of the top men in Lockheed Martin. You know, great, great boys. But the impact that I've had on these lives, I started bringing this up because this ninth step, my ex-wife just keeps coming on my heart. my ex-wife just keeps coming up. Like, I owe her amends. I still owe her amends. Like, I don't know if I could ever make that right, you know. This is a woman who came from a violent house where she was being abused sexually, physically. And I was her knight in shining armor, right? I was a drug dealer with a car and a job. You know, I was the knight in a house, in an apartment. I was like the dream come true. You know? And that didn't happen that way. You know, it was a mess. It was an absolute disaster, you know, for her. Now, look, well, while we were running together, it was fun. You know, but things happened. She grew up. I didn't. You know, she had a child. She got that responsible gene, you know. I didn't know about that. No, no, we can't run anymore. I got to take care of the child. Well, see ya. I gotta go. It was just who I was. It was about me. It was all about me. It was never about what can I do for you? How can I help you? How can I make you happy? What can I do to love you? I learned that all here. But it's a shame that I had to leave that. And I don't even know how you make amends for that. You know, that's, you know, how do you make amends for just destroying someone's life like that? Just being a tornado in somebody's life. You know, that's a difficult thing to do, you know, and you know, the proclamation is there, but where's the demonstration? You know, how do you make the demonstration? That's really on my heart tonight. You know, Tuesday we did the meditation and it came on my heart. I wrote it down and I don't know, you know, our book later in the end of the ninth step talks about servile or scraping, you know. I think I was a little scraping in my first amends, you know, and all that means is we don't beg for forgiveness and we don't go in there with ego either, you know, and I went in there with a lot of ego, you know, and I don't think I've ever really made a proper amends to her, and I don't know if I could ever make that right, you know. It's just that she deserves a sit down, direct one-on-one, you know, proclamation of exactly what harm was done, and that's, you know, the step is about that. I mean, the step is so clear. I mean, it's you know, what kind of amends we make direct amends when, wherever possible. When don't we? When we're going to hurt somebody else, you know, when it will injure other people. It's self-explanatory, but it's difficult. There are great benefits, and that's the way this program works, right? We go through pain, and then we get a great benefit, right? And fourth step is painful. Fifth step, there's relief in promises, results. Eighth step is difficult. The ninth step is difficult, but the promises, there's great results, great, you know, great relief, if you will, in that step. And it's that pain of growth. I mean, growth through pain. You know, the touchstone to our spiritual growth is it comes through pain. And this was not a step that I was looking forward to, and I don't think anybody did. You know, we looked down that list. And by the way, we were talking earlier about, you know, where we fall short. We fall short in five, and we fall short in nine. You know, and that's where we fall short. That's where we kind of jump over. We'll do a couple amends. We'll move into 10, 11, and 12, and we'll forget that it says we move into this step. We move into the world as a spirit as we clean up the past. As we continue to clean up the past, we move into the world. You know, they're talking about as you move into 10, 11, and 12, as you move into the design for living, we're still working on 9. You know, we're not putting that on the back burner. But we want to make those ones that are in front of us and get that right. And get, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I'm sorry. Let me back in the house. No, let me go help other alcoholics. That was my idea, step 9, you know. But it touches on I wanted to read a couple of things. One is that the proclamation has been made. The demonstration's important. And that demonstration starts in 6 and 7. That's where the change takes place. I say this 100 times, that everything leads to 6 and 7 and everything is leading back to 6 and 7. Because if nothing changes, there is no demonstration to match our proclamation, right? I mean, it's just this bullshit word still. And there's no action to back it up. There's no demonstration of change. You know, it's 6 and 7 is so important to go out and do 9. They've got to see something different. And if you're living differently, you look different. I love in Bill's story when Bill says there was something in his eyes. You know, there was something inexplicably different about him. And they see that in us when we're practicing the principles in our lives. When we're practicing this inventory and this confession, and we're aware of our defects of character, and we're working on those defects of character, they see that. They see that there's been a change. We no longer show up as a taker or as much of a taker, right? We may still be taking some, but we not as much. You know, that goes away little by little. But there has to be some kind of demonstration. I have my guys start with sending a freaking card. You know, just send a card. Let me know what your birthday, your mom, your dad, your kids, your cousins. Tell me when their birthdays are. Let's just start sending a birthday card. They'll fall off the table. They'll fall out of her chair when they see a birthday card come from you. You might owe them $100,000, but I'll tell you what, that birthday card will be more than the money. Like, my God, this isn't him. This is so out of character. When I showed up at my mother's house and I brought something with me, my God, that's out of character for you. Yes. Yeah, there's something different, something inexplicably different. She no longer has to hide her purse. I came with something. I wasn't coming to get something. So there has to be some demonstration. One of the most important lines in the ninth step on page 77, it says, we go to them, him, her, with a helpful and forgiving spirit. This is about forgiveness. You know, this is about forgiveness. This is about cleaning our side of the street up and forgetting theirs. And they're talking about direct amends right there. The type of amends that we're going to do, if we can, is direct. And they're talking about people going to people that may have hurt us also and maybe hurt us more than we hurt them. But we're going there to clean our side of the street up. Our life depends on cleaning our side of the street up. Our life depends on getting rid of the guilt, remorse, and shame, not theirs. There has to be a demonstration on our part. You know, that's, I think, the number one rule. You know what came to mind when I read that line? My father. I resented my father terribly. Right? My father was on my four-step. I didn't have anything to put in column four. What did I do? I didn't do shit. You know, I was a victim. And I played that victim role. I was five when he left. You know, what part did I play in that? Anybody read the story in the back of the book, Freedom from Bondage? Yeah, I used that as an excuse to be pissed off. I used it as an excuse not to be successful. You know, oh yeah, you had a father behind you. You had somebody looking out for you. You had somebody watching over you. You know, I played that card anytime I could. I didn't have a normal childhood. You had a normal childhood. I used him as an excuse. I needed to go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit. And he's a great example of someone who didn't want to hear it. Great example. If that had been an employer, he might have thrown me out of the room. This not drinking thing was out of the question for him. Like, you know, come see me when you're ready to have a drink. That was what my dad said to me. And that's where he's at. He's just, you know, I wouldn't use the word asshole, but that's not forgiving. it describes him accurately, but I'll tell you what it made me do. It made me look at my father's childhood. It made me look to see how he was raised, right? And he was raised by two drunks, mother and father, right? His dad used to come home and wake his boys up and have them compete against each other, have them fight each other. They would steal each other's shit from him. Talking about a dysfunctional childhood. And I started to understand how he became the person that he is. Can't condone it. I don't approve of it. But I understand. You know, and I could find some peace in that. I could find some relief in that. And I reach out to him every now and then and to see if there's anything I can do for him or is there any way I can be helpful to him. And he's just out there. You know, he is who he is. He's, you know, 83 years old now. He's been drinking a half a fifth of vodka every day to go to sleep since he was a young guy, and that's just who he is. You know, he's never going to change. You know, he's just not a good guy. You know, and one-on-one, I might tell you some stories, but I'm not going to put that on tape. I'll tell you that. He's an amazing guy. Rule number one, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. We're going in there to make amends, not to create more amends, right? We don't argue. We don't. They can go off. We can give them a chance to go off. We can let them vent. But we don't go there. We're just there to clean off our side of the street. That's it. That's rule number one. Rule number two, never try to tell them what they should do or what they should have done. You know, we don't go there. You know. Rule number three, his faults are not discussed. So what they did to us is not discussed. You know, it's just about us. You know. And then the book goes on to say, we get thrown out of the office, so be it. We are not servile. We are not going to beg somebody to accept our amends. I would end with this. Is there anything I could do to make this right? And if they say no, adios. You know, we did the best we could. And we pray for them, right? Our book gives us prayers and resentment. We treat them as we would a sick person, as we would a sick friend. You know? Is there anything I can do? No? Then I'm out of here. And then the book talks about, you know, different types of amends. You know, it's funny that they should touch on money, the first one. But most of it, you know, to be honest with you, most of it, I don't know, look, I owed a ton of money. I mean, I had this other problem that I think I share with you guys. I was spending $300 a day to make 80. You know, not a smart move. It created a lot of debt, a lot of credit card debt, like six-digit credit card debt, you know. And it was a lot. And I remember my sponsor. I kept saying to my sponsor, do you know how long it'll take me to pay that back? And he goes, yeah, the same amount of time as if you never send him a dime. Start sending him some money. And, you know, thank God for Bill Wilson. He says, you know, arranging the best deal we can, you know. And that's what I did. I started calling him. I owed $100,000 when I got here to credit cards. I was snorting my paychecks and paying mortgages with credit card checks, you know. And I made the best deal I could. I started closing accounts and making deals with them. I started shifting the ones that wouldn't close to no interest credit cards. And, you know, it took me 10 years. I was 10 years sober whenever I paid off all my credit cards. I was debt free, you know. It was just, took time. You know what? It's just about being willing to start somewhere. You know, send them 100, start with one, start sending them whatever you can a month, $20, $50, $100, whatever it is. Just start chipping away at it. It's about, once again, demonstration. It's about willingness to make the amends. I had I do a big book study I've been doing for about 10 years at a halfway house in Pompano. A couple hundred guys and gals. And I was talking about this amends that I still had out there. And there's this police officer from Pittsburgh that one night we got tired of him hassling us. You know how that is. You know, when you're dealing drugs on a corner, they hassle you. You know, because you're not supposed to. And it's, I don't know why they think they own the corner, but you know, they tell you can't hang out there anymore, and they pick you up and take you in once in a while and search you and do all that crap. You know. And so we were sick of that crap, so we decided to redesign his Monte Carlo one night. And so we painted it and broke some windows out in it, and that didn't go well. But we ended up copping a deal with them that if we turned ourselves in, they just wanted us to make restitution. And it was $800 a piece that we had to pay, and I never paid them. And, you know, I never even thought about it until I was doing this big book study. I was about 6-7 years into this big book study, and I don't know where it comes from. It comes out of nowhere. It just comes on my heart that I still owe this amends to this guy of $800, you know, this cop. And I didn't do anything, you know. I kind of made a mental note of it and said, you know, someday I'm gonna have to address that. And I kind of shared it with, you know, I shared it with the group that was there, and it takes us 9 months to get through the book. The way we go through the book. And we're coming around the cycle again. And we're on the ninth step again. And I can't share this thing one more time with them. I can't believe that I've spent a year or 9 months and not done anything about this amends that I shared with these guys. So I decide to do something about it. And because I just don't want to share again that I didn't do anything. And I started calling Pittsburgh and the Wilkinsburg PD to try to find Nick. Right? Well, they call it stalking. And they wouldn't tell me where he was, and which I get. You know, I guess there's a lot of people that look for cops and for the wrong reason, and they didn't believe what I was trying to do. And so, you know, I did what I could. I got the Pittsburgh phone books. I looked up his name, tried making some phone calls. I never got a hold of him. So, you know, there's some amends that we're going to have to make indirect amends with. And this was one that I did. And what I decided to do with it was make donations in Nick's name, without my name on it, to the Pittsburgh Homeless Children's Fund. And I sent them, you know, $100 a month until I paid off the $800. And it turns out I really liked the fund anyway, so I send them some money still. But it was my way of saying I did the best I could to make the amends, you know, and clear my conscience and get free of that. And that's what this is about. This step is about getting free. You know, this is the guilt, remorse, and shame. This is the one form, the other forms of spiritual sickness that we didn't do anything about in step four. And I was able to get free of that, and I was able to share that. I was able to do that amends the best I could. And I always laugh, and I always say, you know what's going to happen is I'm going to run into Nick, and Nick's going to ask for his $800, and, you know, I'm going to give him his $800, you know, and I will. I would love to do that. One of the reasons why I think I never did anything about it is because I wanted to see Nick face to face. You know, I really wanted to make a proclamation to Nick of how, not just how sorry I was, but how wrong I was to do something like that. And I would have loved to have been able to see him face to face and make that admission. But you know, that's the way it is. I mean, there's, you know, if you've shoplifted CVS or Walgreens, are you going to go to the manager and say, I've been stealing from you for the last 6 years? Here I am. I doubt it. You know, might not be a good idea, especially if you have children or you're in a relationship or you have a family. Probably not a good idea. You could see what charities that CVS is involved in or Walgreens is involved in and start making some donations to that charity and try to pay stuff off. You know, look, put a number on it. That's why I tell my guy, put a number on it. What did you steal? What's the number? And let's start making donations and see how that works out, you know. I mean, there's all kinds of ways. One of the ones that was really working on me was the IRS. And you know, I share with you guys, I can't do my taxes. It's just I don't have the conscience for it. You know, I know that doesn't sound good coming from somebody with a lot of time, but it's a crisis of conscience. You know. I have this debate with myself when I'm doing my income tax, and it gets really sick. You know, I start wanting to write off dinners that and make it like I had a business dinner there, and because everybody does it, I have this justification that goes back and forth. So I just don't do my taxes. I give it to my accountant. Tell me what I owe, and I'll pay it. Or sometimes I get money back. You know, it depends on what he does. But I remember with Brian when I was going through the steps with Brian. We were doing this fourth step, and I'd look at him and say, "Am I going to have to call the IRS?" And he said, "Don't worry about that. We're not on 9 yet. We're on 4." You know, I mean, every time I saw him, no, really. I mean, let's just be clear here. Am I going to have to call the IRS and tell them that I've been cheating on my taxes for the last God knows how many years? And he goes, "Don't worry about it. You're on step 4. We worry about it when we get to step 9." And what he's telling me is a lot of this stuff just comes to the surface, right? A lot of people that we don't think we'll ever see, they show up. A lot of amends that we don't think we'll ever be able to make, we are able to make. We don't know where we're going to be in 10 years. We don't know where we're going to be in 15 years. I know I wasn't making enough money then, but maybe I'll be making enough money 5 years or 10 years from now. We don't know. And that's why we try to live in the now and not try to imagine that we're never going to be able to pay them back, you know. But funny thing happened. I got a letter from them. I didn't have to call them. They called me. And that's just how it works. You know, that's just how it works. People that you thought you'd never see show up in front of you. And I ended up going to the IRS. And I think what did it was that I got sober in March and filed my first ever legitimate tax return in April. And it must have thrown a flag up. It's like this don't look nothing like the last 10, you know. And so I I did what the book says. I sought counsel. You know, I took an accountant with me to the IRS meeting, and I told him what happened. I said, I don't know what's on those tax returns. I have no clue. I know what's on this one. I got sober in March, you know, and I started practicing some principles that this program tells me I need to practice, and I know what's on this return, but those other ones, I have no idea what it's on. This is Mr. C. He is an accountant. And he's going to take care of it from here. So you guys just figure out what I owe and let me know. And they did. They went back that a year before, and I owed them $800 in penalties plus a couple $1,000s in taxes. And they stopped. And they stopped. And they called me into their office, and they said, I don't know what you guys are doing up there, but whatever it is, just keep doing it. And whether I wasn't a big enough fish for them or whether God intervened, I don't know, you know, but they said, just, you know, stay the course, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And that was the end of it. And I was able to put that behind me. Do you know what it felt like every time I got an IRS letter in the mail? You know, I would pretend it wasn't there, you know, like, oh, geez, I just set it on the table and hope it would disappear. You know, I mean, I my heart would fall. And that's what we're getting free of, right? That's what we're getting freedom from, is that feeling. You know, I mean, even today it's a little bit, but I know that I'm cool. You know, I know that, and usually it's just a 941 form or a 940 form or a UTC-6 or something like that. You know, it's one of those forms. But still, I used to just hide this shit. You know, like, maybe it'll disappear. Maybe it'll go away. And now I don't have that. I'm free from that. And, you know, the book right after that, you know, talks about criminal stuff, you know, that we need to get free of that stuff. We need to clean up that feeling when a cop pulls up behind you that the stomach just falls to your feet, you know, it's scary stuff. You know, we need to get free of that stuff. That's the stuff that takes us back out, you know. That's the stuff that's the whole point of this exercise, is to eliminate that and to get free from that. You know, get free from the debt that you owe people. Get free from the power that people have over us. And the cops had power over me. You know, I had stuff out there. You know, I didn't even know some of it was out there. But they found you. They found me. That's how that happens. You know, and look, I've worked with a lot of guys that had a lot of history, and guys that not everybody comes to South Florida because of the weather. You know, a lot of people come to South Florida because it's very far from the north. You know. And there's a warrant or there's something going on up there, you know, that they got to get away from. And I get that. I get that. But at some point, you have to get free of that, because that's the stuff. That's the spiritual sickness. When Bill talks about the spiritual malady, he's talking about the effect that that has on us. That's what he's talking about. The effect the conflict has on us. I can't be in conflict. I drink over conflict. I drink over uncomfortability. Conflict is uncomfortability. And I don't want to walk the street. Not that I even can't. I don't want to walk the street anymore. Every time a cop car passes me, my heart falls to the ground. You know? Or every time or scared to death that I'm going to get pulled over. The ambulance hits their lights and I freak out. You know? I don't want to live like that anymore. I don't have to live like that anymore. But it gives us directions. Seek counsel. If you got a warrant up north, seek a lawyer. Seek a PD or something. Get somebody on the phone. Ask them what's going to happen when you come up there and surrender yourself. Make a plan. I've done it with a lot of guys. You know, alimony is a big thing. You know, alimony, child support. You know, right. A lot of guys have had to go up north and make amends for that stuff, and here. The book even gives us a specific on that, and then it works. Write a letter, send some money. Right? Write a letter and send money. Right? And promise to make good on the rears, but get current. You know? Take care of your children, for God's sake. I mean, you know, I hate to get mean, but, you know, just take care of your kids. It's your responsibility. You know? And that's just the deal. You know? I remember I first come in here and I shared with you guys I was under a restraining order, and my wife was suing for alimony and child support, emergency alimony and child support. And I would sit there and whine to this men's group that I was with. And I'll never forget Dennis O. God rest his soul, he passed away about a year and a half ago. And I said to Dennis, you know, she wants $1,000 a month in child support. He says, what are you, some kind of, he was a Chicago gangster, you know, what are you, some kind of deadbeat? It's what? What kind of deadbeat are you? You know, you don't want to take care of your kids? Why would you not take care of your kids? He said, where did she get the number? I said, I think a judge. He said, pay the money. Take care of your children. What's wrong with you? That's a good question. What's wrong with me? That was a good question. Why would I not want to take care of my... What man would not want to take care of his children? I don't... It baffles me today, but I was that guy when I got here. Like, I want to bargain for what it costs to take care of my children. Can we negotiate that? Yeah, but she's taking the house, Dennis. What, are you going to kick your kids out of their bedrooms? What's wrong with you? That's a good question. I don't know what's wrong with you. But now that you put it that way, you know. But that's what I was doing, right? I want my house. Why did I want the house? Because it was me. I was the house, right? I was the ice cream truck, right? I was the house. That house was everything I want. That house was my equity. That house was me. That was everything I thought I had worked for all my life. My whole identity was that house. I have to have that house. And what he would say is, even if your children get kicked out into the street, what is wrong with you? Man, these guys were waking me up, you know. I saw Dennis about 3 weeks later. He says, how's that house thing going? I said, I don't care about that house anymore. He says, you'll probably keep it. Little did I know, you know, 27 years later, I'm still in that house. You know, she didn't want the house. She only wanted the house because I wanted the house. Right? Once I surrendered the house, she didn't want it anymore. She, matter of fact, she said, I can't afford it anyway. It's yours, you know. But it's about responsibility, right? It's about getting clean, right? It's about just getting relief, getting free, you know. But, you know, I actually have situations where we wrote letters, and it didn't happen right away. Sometimes it took a year. Sometimes it took 2 years of sending some back child support. And now I know a guy that his two boys live with him now. You know, they live half a year down here and half the year with their mother up north. You know, those miracles take place if we're willing to make the effort to make the amends. I had an amends come up recently for me that I didn't even know was out there. You know, I decided to get a concealed weapons permit, and which is really crazy because the Department of Agriculture deals with that in Florida. That's kind of wild. You know, that baffles me in a way how they got involved in concealed weapons permits. But I get my concealed weapons permit, and I go to buy a gun, and they won't sell me the gun. And I said, how can you do that? How can you give me a concealed weapons permit? How can you give me the ability to carry a gun concealed but not sell me a gun? And the gun owner said, you should probably keep that to yourself before they take away the permit. He said, there's something out there. There's a warrant out there. So I get an attorney who's in the program, a friend of mine, and there's an open felony, an open trafficking charge, a felony charge from 1974. Sitting in the courts in Pennsylvania, right? And I was framed, by the way. It was, yeah, I was definitely innocent. It was his. It was not mine. That was my first trip to county. That was interesting. So we looked into it, and what there was still an open charge. There was no degree or no disposition to the charge. Now, I remember the court proceedings very well. And I remember the case being thrown out. Now, my buddy did 2 years, but I remember the case being thrown out against me. But there it is, right? You don't even know that it's out there, and it finds you. Now, it takes me a couple $1,000s to get rid of it, you know, because I have to go into the records and exploratory stuff, and they have to go into... Thank God that it was so long ago they couldn't find it, you know, and decided they had to... I had to pay to get it expunged, but it's amazing that that stuff doesn't go away. If you don't address it, it will address you somewhere down the road. My, you know, my ex-wife is one that I still have to do something about. I, you know, I don't, you know, when you're talking about family and relationships, I don't know how you ever make some of that stuff right. You know, sometimes the proclamation, even the demonstration, isn't enough. You know, I don't know how I'll ever pay my mother back for all the sleepless nights, you know, that I kept her up. And, you know, the money was nothing. I've since, you know, made amends for the money. I mean, they've been in a situation where my mother's been sick and she hasn't been able to work and they've needed money, and I'm in a position where I can help them out. So it's, you know, it's the financial amends is there, but I don't even think they care about that, you know. I remember when I first wanted to make amends to my mom and my stepfather and, you know, told them, you know, that I was wrong, I should have never stole your car, you know, and that's what my poor stepfather, I would take his car to the store and not come back, you know. And he would take his bus to work for a week or two while I had his car, you know. And sometimes it would come back on a flatbed, missing tires, and, you know, it would just, I mean, what I put him through, I actually probably caused their divorce. And they ended up, after all the kids were gone, they ended up getting back together. And, well, there was 3 out of 4 of us were addicts and alcoholics, so that's what he was dealing with. But I don't think he had any idea what he stepped into. But, you know, the financial amends was the easy part. It's how do I make amends for my behavior? And that comes for whatever they ask, whenever they ask, however ridiculous it is that they ask me to do it, I say yes. I don't care when it is, how inconvenient it is. No matter what my stepfather asks, no matter what my mother asks, I am there. I mean, that's my way of making amends. And I don't even know if they know that, but it's my way of getting free from that regret. But it is still hard, you know, to still look back at some of that stuff. And, you know, my mother was actually last year, when I was doing the step series here, my mother ended up in the hospital. I almost lost my mother last year. And, you know, my sister and I have been in odds for a long time, you know, and we just clash. You know, I don't know if you have any family members. I mean, you got family members like that. That we're like oil and water when we get together. And I decided, rather than argue with my sister all the time, I would just keep her at arm's length. You know, I would just put her outside of my bubble, outside of my circle, and just not have anything really to do with her. You know, when my mother was on her deathbed. And she ended up surviving, but my mother was on her deathbed, literally. And what she said to me was, "Why can't you get along with your sister?" I never imagined how my mother was affected by my relationship, by her 2 children's relationship. And it made me take a whole new look at that situation and realize that I needed to make amends for it. And I called my sister and just made things right. And just, you know, I'm able to accept her for who she is because my mother wishes it. You know, not necessarily that I get along great with her or that I condone everything she does. But my mother needs it. You know, I never thought that there was somebody else that was affected by that relationship. My mother just wants us to get along. And it makes her happy that we get along. And if it makes her happy that we get along, then that's what we're going to do. You know, and I'll be forever making amends for some of this stuff. And I know that most of it's living with them. Most of it with my children is living. I remember sitting with my oldest son and trying to make amends with him. You know, and I thought, you know, since I put him through college and I bought him a car and, you know, everything would be, he would just say, "Hey, everything's cool, Dad. Don't worry about it." You know, and I told him how wrong I was for my behavior and how I wished a lot of that when it never happened. And he said, "Yeah, that sucked." And I thought he was going to say everything was okay, you know. And it gave him a chance to heal. And it gave him a chance to vent and bring up some stuff that he regretted. And a lot of the time, that's what it's about, is giving them a chance to vent. You know, giving them a chance to heal. Letting them hear the truth, you know. And that's not who I am today. And then I'm going to demonstrate that's not who I am today. You know? My ex, you know, there was obviously, infidelity in that marriage, last few years that we were together weren't good. And it ended in a violent note. It ended with me knocking my wife down in front of my kids, our original marriage. And and I don't know how you make amends for that. You know, Bill writes in there, should we, you know, if we've been unfaithful, should we tell them? And thank God Bill wrote it, not Lois, you know, because Bill says not always. I guess Lois would have said, you're damn right you do, you know, and that's a tough thing. And I don't have an answer, by the way. I don't have an answer for that. I don't, what was that? Time up? I don't have an answer whether that, whether that's a thing or due to not. I know this, that I know in recovery that there are bells you can't unring. That I know, you know, and I'm desperate not to ring those bells that I can't unring. No matter what my mind says or no matter where my mind goes, I know that if I ring certain bells, that it's either going to cost me my relationship or it's going to cost me my recovery, one or the other. And if I want to stay sober, I might need to make amends and lose that relationship. And so I have to be very careful. You know, Bill talks about that in step four. You know, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble, which we're going to do. We just have to be careful that when we stumble, we don't stumble to the point where we ring a bell that we can't unring. You know, and we're human beings. We're going to fall short of the chosen ideal. But if we recognize that as bad behavior before it becomes unrepairable behavior, and get back on the right track, we're surely going to stay sober and not destroy that relationship. I'm going to tell you what happened to me. So I don't have an answer for you, by the way. If you're getting back with your ex or you're putting your family back together and you've cheated and you don't know whether you should tell them or not, I don't have an answer for you. I really don't. I think you have to ask yourself, can I stay sober holding this inside? Am I going to sacrifice my serenity or my recovery by not sharing this? And the flip side of that is, am I going to destroy, am I going to do harm to that person by telling her that? Because we have to be careful that if there's children involved, I'm not just harming her, I'm harming children. So there's a lot to think about there. This is, sponsorship is so important. Guidance is so important in this step. You know, you got to counsel with somebody, you know, before you go into a lot of these amends. You don't want to go into amends and wish you hadn't made it and end up having to make amends for making amends. You know, we don't want to go there. But what happened to me was I was asked to speak at this, and not by choice. The speaker didn't show up. I'm about 9 months sober. My ex and I are just starting to talk. I'm just starting to see the kids again. She lifted the restraining order, you know, and I get, the speaker doesn't show up. They ask me to speak. It's a spur of the moment thing. And I said, okay, you know. So I get up there to speak, and I torture these poor people with a fifth step, basically. You know, I don't know about open and closed meetings. I'm 9 months sober. You know, I'm there to just make up a story. You know, that's a lot of what we do. A lot of that when we're new, right? We kind of embellish. So I dumped this fifth step out there, right? And my ex decided to see what this A&A thing was all about. You know, and she came in the back door while I was speaking to see what was going on in there, and she heard everything. She heard about the infidelities. She heard about everything, and I heard, and my buddy Jeff B, he's sitting where you're sitting, and he's going, God, she's back there, and I'm going, no, I got this, Jeff. Yeah, I got, you know, and it wasn't funny that night. You know, we were just starting to reconcile, and if she could have put that restraining order back on, she would have, I guarantee it. But here's what happened, is I'm no longer in bondage in that, and she's getting free because she's pissed off and she's venting, you know. And she's talking about, you told me I imagined all that, I thought I was going crazy, and now she knows she wasn't, right? And now she's on the road to healing also. and I'm free. Now, I don't longer worry about who she runs into, who she sees, who's in the room when she comes in the room, who's she talking to over there, what are they talking about, are they talking about me? I'm free of that, right? And the short story is that we ended up getting back together. As a matter of fact, we ended up remarried a couple of years into recovery, and which could have been a good thing if it had lasted, but it lasted. Maybe I'll talk about that next week, but it was a good thing. It was. We ended up remarried. There were two boys involved. It was good for those boys that we were together, that their parents were together. It was a whole different marriage than it was the first time. There was no violence in the marriage. It's just that, you know, somebody who's a normie can only take so much of this. You know what I mean? Like, I'm all in, right? I'm either all in or all out. I mean, that's just who I am. People that know me know that I chase this thing still today like I did when I got here. I love AA. I love everything to do with AA. I would spend my whole life in AA, and that's a good addiction in my book. It's better than where I was, you know, and I love this program. I love you people. I feel at home in these rooms. Normies don't. You know what I mean? She just couldn't take one more freaking gratitude dinner, you know, one more sober picnic. You know, she just couldn't take it anymore. You know, she wanted to go out and have a couple drinks, a couple nights a week like normies do, you know, and I just didn't want to do that. You know, I didn't want to play. I didn't want to do that. I don't want to go out Saturday night and you have a couple drinks and we sit in a bar somewhere and dance. That was just not my thing, you know. I love being here, you know, and so we ended up separating once the kids were gone. But my kids got their parents together until they left the house, you know, and we left on good terms. It wasn't nasty terms. It was just, you know, she had had enough of AA. That was really what it was about, you know. And in her defense, she never got normal. She had 10 years of total excess, and she had 16 years of total abstinence, you know. She never got normal. She never got what she bargained for, you know. So in her defense, it was probably my fault both times. Yeah. And we'll talk more about this next week because, you know, it takes something like that to rock your world. It takes something like that to have you do some more self-examination and say, where was I in this relationship? Why did I fail in a relationship sober? How could that be? How could I, practicing these principles, fail in a marriage? And there was a lot of self-examination went in there and a lot of growth that came from that. I always talk about the two worst days of my life. One was when I came into AA, and one was when I got divorced sober. I thought were the two worst days of my life turned out to be two of the best days of my life because all of my growth have come from those 2 days. You know, thanks for letting me be here tonight.
All right, thank you, Pat. Can everyone help me give Pat another round of applause?
Hi, my name's Ryan. I'm a recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. And I've asked Damon to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. Hey, Damon.
Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism, recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime, but we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. Page 23. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Um, 1940s-style big book sponsorship from the forward to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experienced is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Awesome. And then is there anybody in the room that needs a sponsor? You could raise your hand. We got a guy in the back there. So if you want to see any of those people that just had their hands raised, they can help get you back to God. Please join us Monday nights for the Big Book Study meeting where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship starts at 6:30 and the Big Book Study starts at 7:15. And we have CDs, mugs, large print Big Books, little red books, and Big Book dictionaries for sale. They're not out, so if you are interested in getting any of that, just see one of us after the meeting. Announcements, I'm going to try and do this from memory. Intergroup. If you need medallions, if you need books, literature, ask anybody in the home group. We can get you the information on contacting intergroup. Also, AA's Got Talent is coming up in February. It's like America's Got Talent, but with drunk people. So start practicing your routine now. We've also got Winterfest coming up this Saturday, and that starts at 5:30. There's going to be karaoke. There's going to be an ugly sweater contest. So you can get your tickets for $8 in advance or $10 at the door. And that is at Nova. Thanks. I think that's it for announcements. The last announcement actually is that we have a 75-foot invisible no smoking and vape zone in front of the doors. There's buckets set up, like when you walk out, just go to the left and you'll follow it all the way down. You'll see some orange buckets. So just go down there and smoke. We got the Boy Scouts downstairs. That's it. See you next week.
Thank you, Brian. For those of you who want to catch the past podcasts, it's all at alcoholicsandgod.org, as well as all our other series, as well as Pat's. I would like to invite everyone to our Monday night Big Book study right here in this very room. And to those who wish to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle. Pat's going to be up here. So we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
See you on Monday or Thursday.
I am desperately in need of restoration. Yeah, and I am ready for you to take me higher. Yeah, the only thing that I can do. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all. And I am willing to hand over every one of them. 'Cause they won't profit me anything. Can't get it right. If
things can't get you right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. On my own, I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man.
Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Each day in a brand new way, show up and plug in my guitar. songs, and people sing along, and stomp their feet and raise their arms. And here in this moment that we share, nothing could come in. Lessons when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now, and everything's all right. Oh man, going on 10 years old, that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.